we're back here in the restaurant with Larry Austin here on Calvus and Damon. Things are still loud. The ice is crashing into the buckets. And we're still eating.
That's a performance piece. Aren't you aware?
Ah.
Just across the street from the New England Conservatory, and there is a group of performers here. And it's ice music over there.
Ice music. Oh, right.
Right.
So we were finishing up the story of Open Style.
Yeah.
And
by the way, it wasn't a movement. It was a one-man movement. I think no one else took up the banner, as it were.
Nicholas Slonimsky apparently gives great credence to that movement.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hate to explode the myth. But
speaking of myths, there was a CD sort of with that in the title, which reminds me that you are also one of the people behind some of the issuance of a lot of contemporary music, computer music in particular.
Oh, you mean CDCM?
CDCM.
Yeah. Yeah, well, CDCM stands for the Consortium to Distribute Computer Music, which is quite a formidable academic style title, but and in fact it was a consortium of prominent American electroacoustic and computer music studios back in 86. I invited six other computer music composers who also happened to head electronic music studios, computer music studios, and around the United States to meet me in Den Haag, where the International Computer Music Conference was being held that year in 1986. CDs were, even in 1986, were new. In fact, most composers didn't have a CD player, much less a CD burner. CD burners were just, in fact, not even considered,
I don't think
by that time. It would cost a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah.
You could get one, but it would cost, what, $5,000-$6,000?
Only in the big production place.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I had this idea that we could all lock arms and ask our various institutions to put up some money and cut some CDs. In fact, a year later, we had plans for the first several CDs. And the first release on Centaur Records was in fall 1988. We continued through the years with two or three CDs a year, coming from those studios, and then with NEA grants and Aaron Copland music recording grants and other kinds of subventions, we managed through the years to now we're at volume 32, just came out. So I, with volume 30, I resigned the position of president of CDCM, which meant I just did all the work. Not all the work, I had colleagues, but and John Nelson at the University of North Texas is now the president, and continuing that, we have a contract with Centaur Records to go through volume 40. I don't know if it will continue through that time, but it has had a lot of circulation, subscribers, and a fine repertory of current pieces that involve computers, either computer-assisted or computer-generated music. The thing that I think, looking back, that it characterizes it is that it's the great preponderance. Most of the titles are computer music plus instrumental instruments. even orchestra and so forth, with solo CDs thrown in from time to time. So it's different from other series, I think, in that respect. And I guess that ties in with what I said before in terms of my own predilection from the very beginning of my work with electronic music. But always, at least at first, I was primarily involved with performers and electronic music.
Let's get also back to the sort of difficulty you have. You were at our Otwan Festival in 2001. And one of the presentations was your Williams Remixed,
yeah.
And it is an 8-channel piece.
Yeah.
How is it possible to maintain a sort of a good spirit as a composer when you are limited to venues where the possibility of 8 channels exists?
Well, it produces a great difficulty, of course, but more and more specialized venues have multi-channel installations, especially in Europe. It's not as common in the United States. In Canada, of course, multi-channel is almost commonplace, certainly in Montreal, and where the acousmatique school is very strong and has a very highly developed audience and so forth. The same thing goes for Paris, certainly, and now in England over the last 10 years. Multi-channel installations are commonplace. In fact, in just 2 weeks, I'll be going to London, where I'll be giving a presentation of octophonic music at Goldsmiths College. And so when I made myself available to them, I said, do you have an octophonic installation? Yes, they do, and so forth. But it's a good point you make. However, now surround sound is almost complex, mostly in Dennis. Did you know that's where they sell most of the surround sound installations? Is at Dennis, so that the patients can be surrounded by sound and not think about that dental work that they're having done. It's true, or at least it was several years ago. Now there's 8.1, 5.1, and so forth.
So
and
these
with
are
DVD, these things are becoming...
Have you reworked some of your own stuff for these encoding systems yet?
Experimented with it.
Okay.
Yes. Right now, I have to use ADATs or DA88 tape, in other words, or for a computer,
right,
which has that kind of output.
Right. Since we're talking about multiple channels, let's hear some of them. This is the famous Williams Remixed composition from 1997 to 2001, based on John Cage's Williams Mix from 1951 to 53. Larry has taken it and done some real marvelous restorations of the theme and then worked it from there. We first heard this in 8 channels at the Otwan Festival of Non-Pop in 2001, and it was very exciting. Here, unfortunately, for you, our listener, it's going to be in stereo. Here we are, all of the sections of Williams Remixed, Larry Austin. Thank you.
Thank you. 1800.
Thank you.
what were the circumstances?
Good.
And we were going
David and we had a John would come. So he I think
yeah.
Oh,
okay.
What was it like for John?
Well, always
Colonel Richard Ranger.
All the way in the door.
He had invented his own stereo system.
I must say,
each having six times that they're marked with one, and they're density, especially when you try to relate all the track. Density and sound comes from the monitor. Okay, we're talking. We're.
Square.
That's right.
Williams remixed Larry Austin. What is the experience of these many channels of sound? What do they offer that, you know, the stereo or even the sort of encoded surround sound had? What's the difference in the experience? I mean, we have radio listeners who are obviously hearing us only in stereo. So what experience would they, what richness would they gain by hearing this in its actual form?
Well, it becomes more like natural sound. I mean, we're surrounded by sound here in the restaurant. And to recreate that in stereo, you'd say, yeah, that's a recording of a restaurant. But if we were able to, or if we wanted to, recreate that in a performance space, we could more easily and better recreate the environment using multi-channel tapes and speakers and so on. I guess that's the basic difference.
As a composer, though, what creative option is there that makes it possible for you to create in that realm that is uniquely different in your communication with your listener?
Movement and coloration. The coloration is clearer. Movement of sound in the space, if you carefully configure the speakers and the space is right, And the seatings, right, of course, they have to be close to the center usually. Though with ambisonics,
you can sit practically anywhere. That's a multi-channel technique been developed especially in England, where in fact you don't have to sit in the center. So what I found since I got my aquaponic gear, especially, and I have a studio with 8.1 speakers and so forth, what I found is that I feel I'm in the middle of the mixer.
Uh-huh.
I feel like I really am very highly sensitized to sound placement, so that you do listen to reflections of sound. Of course, in the concert hall, we'll be hearing
Sure. Piece
where that certainly is a crucial issue, and we do hear the sound bouncing, refractions, and so
plus
forth.
Plus, you have 50 different sound sources as it comes to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm still experimenting, actually. It's much more practical just to go with a couple of speakers, certainly. But I hope the listeners, when you play my octophonic CD, talk to me, had some sense of how sound was moving constantly in the stereo field. The standard is stereo, but the humming standard, I think, may approach the surround sound possibilities that I'm working with.
I know you have to go to your pre-concert talk in just a few minutes, so
yeah.
Just another question. If you reflect back over the past half century, what is it like to be a composer now for you? Is this a more rewarding time for you?
It's different. It's not more rewarding. Different. I'm 71 years old now, and so, in fact, there is this reflective nature. I always have... my music's always been about music. Music about music. It's self-reflexive. And so my latest piece that I'm working on, from Michael Lowenstern, by the way.
Oh, Michael, good, excellent.
And octophonic, but he said I must have it in stereo to travel. At any rate, great bass clarinet player. It's called Thranos. And it's a music, another piece where it's a music about music. In this case, it's about Dido and Aeneas of Henry Purcell, which is one of the saddest pieces in all time, a lament. And I couldn't help myself. It was difficult after 9/11 even to get my composing together. I did have a session with Michael in Brooklyn and had him play some sequences from that piece and Lamentations and the Dies Irae, and now I'm processing them and they've become a third music, as it were. And I'm really I've had the block pulled away. The difference now for me as a composer, though, is not only reflecting on what you've done, but I care a lot more, I think, about detail now, because I don't have any deadlines certainly from the university, being retired from the university. And when I accept a commission, I work out the deal so that I have plenty of time to dwell on details, and that's the luxury I'm enjoying now. So I'm probably not as productive as I was that year I described, 1964-65, where I wrote 10 pieces. My God. Or that I described writing this orchestra piece in 3 weeks and scoring in one.
Right.
I can't imagine doing that today.
Maybe you just need a little extra caffeine in your diet.
Right.
All right, well, we're going to meet you over at the concert. And,
it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us on Calvus and Damien. We hope we will see you at Zip 3 Non-Pop 2003.
I look forward to it. I'll be there.
Great. Oh, good. Larry Austin, thanks very much.
Thank you. From the show.
We'll wrap up the music of Larry Austin here with one of our favorite topics, lunch.
This is music from a set called Singing the Music of My Own Time, sung with the voice of Thomas Buckner, one of the previous guests on Calvus and Damien a few years ago. Here it is, Larry Austin's Lunch.
And the voice changed things a lot. I think maybe we didn't have 3,000 boardings for it. Again, the only thing I really liked the best was singing. I was singing in the Greek club at that school, like starting with freshman year, and I was the only freshman in the Greek club. We had almost no social activity special. I was pushing my voice up and trying to be a first tenor when actually my voice had really changed and I was American. So that year I started singing on the choir. I stayed a first tenor for too long. Then I kind of got rid of it. That's been a crisis to me about my life as a singer. When I think as you know, people grow up at different rates. I was one of the teachers kind of late. I didn't grow my height until my senior year. And the same thing vocally in Garfield development wasn't there for a long, long time. Even though my comfortable range is more baritone, I said, well, you want to consider because you have a right of quality. I don't work with I really enjoy doing that. And there was nobody there who was as interested in music as I was. So I got to be the musician for like the theater company, and I wrote the theater department. And I wrote, sang the lead in all the musicals and wrote music for all the plays. So it was really fun. I had a real active musical life as a singer and fledgling composer. Whereas had I been in a larger group, I might have maybe gotten to one project. I was constantly writing or singing. It was really neat. There I would come back to New York. I studied periodically with the teachers that I found in New York. Carolina Segrera Holden. She was a good former opera singer, older woman. She helped me a lot. And I had a routine there for the practice. And I would vocalize. But it's nice to work with people. Although I actually wrote original music for the plays, and some of them were not set. And sing it, and teach the other people how to sing it. You know, learning just by doing and having to come up with the standard right away. No tolerance if you're not dealing with the public. Being in a larger community of actors, the music writers, very interesting part of the first came out with the touch of that. Can't do that in San Francisco. And so I really, really enjoyed it. It was partly from the experience of coming to the New Music New York event where I met you in 1979. That made me think, well, that's there. Those guys are all there. I could be there too. I hadn't gone to that. I might not have ever gotten the idea. It's a special event.
So, this is wonderful. Thank you.
Here we are, back in
the... I feel younger, having lived through that interview,
yes,
sort of.
Yes, and full, because we ate.
Yeah, but somehow the fullness hasn't transmitted itself, to, at least to my sort... Yeah, I'm still hungry.
In your case, it would be fulsomeness.
That's it. That's me, fulsomeness.
Yes. Well, next week, here on Calvis
what?
And Damon... Yes.
You mean this is weekly?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's weekly 3 times a month.
Ah, that makes more sense.
And,
yes.
And the reason that is because the 4th time a month is Noise Punk and Das Kröner.
If they continue as they have been doing.
They have been, and we have a new show posted last week of Noise Punk and Das Kröner, so it proceeds apace two different kinds of approaches to...
And what is a cumulative monetary arrangement that both Kröner and House are realizing? Do you happen to know?
At calvos.org, there's a very lovely button to PayPal, and that remuneration comes from you, our listeners.
Please help.
Yes, please help, because the servers ain't cheap, my friends, and we like to get this stuff out to you. So, next week, I was saying.
You were.
Yes, we again take another time trip with Rosalie Hirse to the beautiful...
She's here?
In
you
downtown.
Here? Rosalie's here?
Rosalie's not here. She's here, but she's not here.
Okay.
And we time travel back to Amsterdam in 2005, where we sat on the Zingel, the canal, and had some sort of...
Stolpertals.
We had apple stuff.
Apple right.
And coffee, which you clinked a lot, just for effect.
Of course.
Which I've carefully excised. No. Only the loud ones, the ones that caused the meter to go into the red. Anyway, Rosalie Hirse is here in the house via Amsterdam next week. And then the week after, which will be July 19th, is a Calvos and Damien special live on the air. So July 19th, 2008, in case you're listening later, is the date of an extravaganza with 60 by 60. Rob Voisin and Ann Kamen will be in the studios of WGDR, and you can listen live at WGDR.org and call in your favorite electroacoustic tunes. And we know there's nothing more favorite than electroacoustic tunes.
But, of course, they need to be 60 seconds or less.
Yes, absolutely.
Not any of your John Cage lengthy pieces. Not 3 minutes and 44 seconds. That just won't do. We could play 1 minute of it.
Well, 3 minutes and 44 seconds is
how about 4:33? Yes,
I reversed the name. You were short a few minutes of silence.
It's the LTMLDRB kicking in again.
So it was. Okay. All right. So until next week with Rosalie Hearson, 2 weeks from now, July 19th, with Rob Voisey and a live 60 by 60 extravaganza.
We're leaving the house, but we'll leave the light on for you.
They will atone and say.